Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I did a cruel thing about a week ago. I was at a reception, a leading figure sort of in political life, intellectoid political life, was a speaker, and this was after he had spoken, and this was a reception for him. I was in his circle when, or heading towards his circle, when along came a young person I know who had, if not a favor to ask, at least she wanted some sort of recognition for something she had recently written and which she knew I had read. And I gave her, I realized only afterwards, very short shrift, because I was headed for the important guy who was getting a lot of attention and whom I know, and he knows me. And I had to kind of determine and demonstrate, I think, to the world that I had that kind of connection with him. I felt rather bad about all of this, and now I feel less bad about it because reading Dario Mastroianni's new book, Games Primates Play, An Undercover Investigation of the Evolution and Economics of Human Relationships, I learned that in a way that was inevitable. It wasn't a full free will choice on my part to ignore the young person and to seek further interaction with a more important, powerful, well-known person. It's in my more or less instinctive or hardwired repertoire.
Yeah, we live in a competitive world, and we also compete for attention. So people who are popular get more attention. We like people who are famous, who have high status, and they tend to be older people who are better known.
But I was older than the guy whose attention I was seeking. But we are, in fact, rather old friends, so it's permissible on that basis. But I was a little bit abrupt, or and thus in a way unkind. I must have been, because I worried about it later to the young lady who wanted me to. Actually, she was wanting me to read something she had recently written and wanted to send it to me, and that was the question. But the guilt I felt, in a way, I cannot forgive myself on, because it was in my, I don't want to say my genes, but it was in my evolutionary repertoire.
Yeah, but you were nice enough to offer to read her manuscript, and then you felt guilty about not talking with her. So this is all part of human nature, so it's not all bad.
But what you do in your book, Games Primates Play, is you say that many of these things that we think are our own choices, our own free will, are in fact not just determined as a matter of true volitional openness, but are in fact are primed and are patterned so that we can't avoid doing them. And it's very similar to what our primate relatives, in the case of your major laboratory animals, the rhesus macaque monkeys, but also surely the higher anthropoid apes, the chimps and the gorillas, they do the same. We are, in fact, as Desmond Morris called us many years ago, the naked ape.
Well, I try to make the case that if there is a human nature, I think it's mainly expressed in our social behavior, so in our social relationships. And that's because in our relationships with our family members, friends, business partners, romantic partners, you name it, we tend to face recurring problems that are not really new. We have problems of altruism, cooperation, faithfulness, commitment, competition, dominance hierarchies. So we solve these problems with solutions that are not new either. So we tend to use the same solutions that our ancestors have used because these are good solutions. So we haven't invented anything new.
We've heard from one of our two guests, Dario Mastroianni, and our other guest, Paul Reber, is a psychologist, a well-established one, who is the head of the Brain and Behavior and Cognition Program at the Department of Psychology at Northwestern. And he has read this book, as have I, the book Games Primates Play. Do you think I can now forgive myself on the basis of what we've just worked out? I was just being sort of a naked gorilla.
I think the idea that we have those instincts that about how these social hierarchies occur is fascinating, but yet we still have to take kind of responsibility for our actions, right? You might have this the sense of like where you are in the social hierarchy, but you still had to accept the responsibility of walking away from the young woman to meet with your old friend. And so it's good to know where that instinct comes from, and yet we still, I think, have to, take that into our model of what we think of as human nature.
And we should temper our, quote, instinctive or our sociobiologically given responses. We should temper or control them with our higher consciousness and with our ethical standards.
Right. Those things that we have that the other primates don't. That doesn't mean we can't learn a lot by looking at where those instincts come from in primates. But remember, in humans, they're kind of filtered through a lot of higher
machinery.
I suddenly
realize I'm saying what E.O. Wilson said a long time ago about human aggression. It's given. It's genetically patterned. It's part of our evolutionary heritage. But we ought to be But we're smarter than the apes, so we ought to be able to control ourselves.
Yeah, biology is not destiny. The fact that we have tendencies to behave in a certain way, that doesn't make every behavior acceptable. We have moral rules. We decide what's socially, morally acceptable and what's not. And so it doesn't matter where it comes from, whether it comes from our genes or our culture. We decide what's acceptable.
I might try to violate and break some of the rules because my higher consciousness requires me to, but I could not possibly get out of the pattern that you say all human beings show when they're on an elevator with other people that they don't know. And I want to get directly to elevator dynamics after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return directly to Paul Reber of the Psychology Department at Northwestern University and Dario Mastrofieri, who is in so many different departments at the University of Chicago. That's the way they do it there. But your basic appointment or your intellectual home, so to speak, is at the Committee on Comparative Human Development.
The Department of Comparative Human Development.
It's now a department. It used to be a committee and a part of the psychology department when I was in that psychology department. Basic question to Paul Reber. When were you last on an elevator for not just for one or two floors, but for 8 or 10 or more floors?
The last time I was on an elevator, I think, was at the Palmer House in Chicago at the meeting of the Cognitive Neuroscience Society. I'm not sure we went 8 floors, but we did have to go up several to get to the meeting rooms.
Well, 6. No, that doesn't fit, though, because there you knew some of the people on the elevator as you were riding, I imagine. You knew some of the other
Some other attendees at the conference, but not everybody that well.
Because the situation that Dario starts with rather early in the book is two people, or maybe it's three, on an elevator, and they don't know one another. How do they behave? You say that's totally predictable.
So a few years ago, I was living on the 20th floor of a high-rise building in South Loop, Chicago. So every day I took the elevator, and I couldn't help myself but to observe how people behaved. And because it's a huge building and a lot of strangers, it's remarkable how people try to avoid eye contact and try to act indifferent and look at their watch look at the ceiling. They'll even press the floor button that's already been pressed because they don't want to acknowledge your presence. And so, I wonder, I'm interested in explaining behavior, why behave in such a way. And people don't do much research on elevator behavior these days. But back in the 60s, it was a hot topic for research. And an anthropologist named Edward T. Hall wrote a book about personal space. Yeah. And he argued that personal space is like an invisible bubble that people carry around themselves at all times, and that they get uncomfortable when somebody gets too close because it's an invasion of this personal space. He made an analogy with animal territory, so that sometimes we get aggressive because it's equivalent to defending territory. And in my book, I actually have a different explanation. I don't think that we're defending a territory. I don't think that we carry around this bubble. It's just that when you put two monkeys very close to one another who don't know each other very well, there's a high risk of aggression. So especially if these monkeys make eye contact. Direct eye contact in monkeys is a threat. So if you look a stranger in the eye, it means you're threatening this person. At least this is what our unconscious mind thinks.
And that would be true of two humans on an elevator as well, you think?
Yes. So there are some signals that we unconsciously interpret, like a stare. We feel uncomfortable because it's the threatening behavior. So we take these countermeasures, essentially. We act indifferent. We try to minimize the stress of the situation. And that's what we do. We're trying to minimize the risk of aggression.
What happens when you do look at somebody and that discomforts that other person? It will depend upon their social level or the culture from which they come. But it wouldn't be unusual to have somebody respond if you're looking at them in close quarters and that you don't know them. Say, is there something I can do for you? Which is really a kind of or what are you looking at? Or something even more directly angry and aggressive.
Yeah, so that would be risky to address somebody directly if they're looking at you. So the problem of the elevator is they're in restricted space. Okay, yeah. If there were more of a distance between you and a stranger, that would not be a problem. So if you put two monkeys in a cage, essentially you create an elevator situation.
And they go at each other almost always, do they?
Well, it depends. Two males will probably kill each other, but two females instead would first act indifferent and show all the elevator behaviors that people show. But then they would start essentially making small conversation, which is grooming.
Well, now let us note instantly that the basic key to your analysis and to the very considerable empirical research you've done and the interpretations you put upon the data you've collected, the overall intellectual vehicle to which controls this is evolutionary theory or modern variants and versions of evolutionary theory. Therefore, one has to ask, if two monkeys put in a closed space ultimately get aggressive and might kill one another or may try to kill one another, how is that somehow functional, serviceable? How does that become a trait, a behavioral propensity selected by nature for survival?
Well, we live in competitive societies. So the idea is that there are certain individuals that we know very well, our family members, our friends, the people we collaborate with, but then there are strangers, and there are situations in which meeting a stranger could be dangerous. So if you're alone on a street in the middle of the night and a stranger approaches you and starts talking with you, there is a risk that might something bad might happen. So being aggressive or be ready at least to fight is an adaptive response.
Why is it an adaptive response for those rhesus macaque monkeys?
Well, the idea is that whenever two monkeys are close to each other, there's risk of aggression. Monkeys, at least the monkeys that I study, rhesus macaques, live in competitive societies. So they're very careful about who they stay close to. So how close they are to other individuals reflects the quality of their relationships. Two monkeys that are friends sit close together, they walk together. If they maintain a distance, there is a reason for that. So if you force them to stay close, so it's not their choice, the way two people are forced to be close in an elevator, then that might trigger aggression.
It was Hobbes in Leviathan who says, whatever the exact line was, it's more than is commonly represented, that human beings in nature, the life of human beings in nature is nasty, brutish, and short, and really is full of danger and ultimately destruction. Therefore, you need states and you need social systems to control what is inherently in the human being. Is that part of what we're talking about right now?
I don't subscribe to this negative view. I think that for social species such as human beings, for animals like us who live in the company of many other animals, there is a delicate balance between cooperation and competition. We need others. We need to be friendly to them. We need their help or their support. But when resources are scarce, when there's not enough food, not enough money, then we can get competitive. And so it really depends on the quality of life, whether it is cooperation or competition that is prevailing in a particular situation.
All three of us have lived for some time in a special variant of human culture known as academic life. And you've got a lot in your book, Games Primates Play, about the games assistant, associate, and full professors play with one another. Paul Reber, you've been reading this, and you run an important program in the psych department at Northwestern. Did you recognize anything from your own experience or your own colleagues as you read this book?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you can see a lot of that same sort of sense of competition for resources draws out different, you know, kinds of relatively more altruistic or more competitive.
Now, what resources? All of your colleagues at Northwestern are well-fed and well-housed?
I think that's actually a good example that, you know, we have this instinct of, like, you know, taking care of yourself, where with in the animal, the world that might have once been nasty, brutish, and short, but now we have all this higher-level machinery, and so our, you know, sort of competitive instincts are expressed in more complex and interesting ways as we, you know, compete for attention, for example, at meetings where we might, you know, walk away or talk to one colleague over another. That's essentially competing for the scarce resource of other people's attention.
Attention from others is a resource as significant as getting 2,000 calories a day?
Well, I think, you know, in sort of the lives that we've constructed around ourselves, I think people do like, you know, so social affiliation is important. We like to interact with other people. We are sensitive to other people's status. We understand, you know, interacting with high status people conveys some other benefits. And I think.
So it's not just a matter of seeking immediate admiration or immediate liking or immediate bonding. It's also with an eye on your own future.
I think that's where you see this kind of that kind of instinct kind of percolating through, you know, in a different way. We're not like monkeys fighting in a cage, but we have some of that same sort of like, you know, instincts about the world around us.
And the rewards that are to be handed out may not be fully under your control. You start rather early in your book, Dario, with a full description of a system that I'd never really understood before. And I suppose I didn't even know that it really was there. There's a wonderful Italian word. You are, of course, Italian by origin. Raccomandazione, is that the way you say it?
Raccomandazione, recommendation.
Recommendation, raccomandazione. What's this? I've written occasional letters of recommendation. As a younger man, I sought letters of recommendation. Is that what you're talking about?
No, in Italy, a recommendation is a way to try and influence the hiring process. For example, when professors are hired in academia, they might be helped, recommended by their protectors, their family members in some cases, if they're powerful politicians, or former advisors. So there is a nepotistic system where people in power try to influence the outcome of admission process for students or hiring for
professors. You suggest that Italian academic life is rife with this system to the extent that it really corrupts the system.
Yeah, the situation is worse than in the States. I mean, there's a little bit of nepotism here too, but not as bad. But again, it's all related to abundance of resources. So when there's an abundance of resources, there's no need to be so nepotistic because there is opportunities for everybody. That when jobs are few and when there's no funding, then all these nepotistic mechanisms kick in because everybody tries to protect their family members and their proteges.
We start with a scene at a great building in Rome, which really houses at least a portion of the Italian Air Force. And two guys are entering, each with a bag, one a bag full of high-priced cuts of meat, the other full of essentially pharmaceuticals. And that's the mystery. They are waved in by the guard at the door. The mystery is ultimately resolved. How was it resolved?
So that's an anecdote that I tell from my experience in the military service. So yeah. Essentially, there was some corruption into this Air Force barracks. So there were soldiers who were bribing officers with presents from their families, from their businesses, to try and influence the outcome of some decisions that were being made in terms of assignments to various tasks and jobs. So people who wanted to be assigned to good jobs were actively bribing officers. And when I first noticed this, I didn't know what was going on, why anybody would want to bring some raw meat into the barracks. And then I realized what it was used for.
Mm-hmm. Can we do similar routines seeking advantage in this country, in military life? I've been in – have you all been in military? Well, you've been in Italian military life.
No, I have not.
But I don't think you can bribe your way to a better position in the American Army or Navy or Air Force with cuts of meat. I don't know.
Maybe not like that. I mean, corruption is one extreme, but nepotism can take many forms. Essentially, nepotism can be just favoring somebody you know versus somebody you don't know.
There's a great line from the first Mayor Daley, who was accused of nepotism because he had channeled some major city insurance contracts to a son of his who ran an insurance agency, mm-hmm. and he made a very calm response. What's wrong with a father helping to take care of his son? And that was widely quoted.
Yeah, in theory, there's nothing wrong with parents helping their children. The problem arises if by doing so, they break the rules, if they break the law, and so they make others pay a price for their fraudulent behavior.
This is the best of all possible worlds, we are told, by Dr. Pangloss and Voltaire's Candide, but one might raise questions as to whether it might be a better world if somehow we controlled some of the instinctive patterns, the reflexive patterns that we have inherited from our primate neighbors or that we share with our primate neighbors and exerted more ethical control, a matter we've already discussed a little bit and to which we shall advert again. Any adverting we're going to do will continue right after we pause for an update on the evening's news from Bob Kessler.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are talking tonight with Paul Reber of the Psychology Department at Northwestern University and with Dario Maestripieri, who is a neuroscientist with many different appointments at the University of Chicago. The basic one is with the Department of Comparative Human Development. And we're drawing from his book, Games Primates Play. Dario is, of course, Italian by origin, and there's a country neighboring yours in which a very popular and persisting tune goes, Parlez-moi d'amour, redites-moi des choses tendres. Speak to me of love and repeat to me those tender words. Let us speak of love and of human love. Do we find analogues to what we experience, which we label love, or romantic love? Do we find analogs in primate life?
There are species in which a male and a female will form a stable bond, which lasts their whole life, and they raise offspring together. But they have feelings that are equivalent to romantic love.
Actually, we can ask them, but they don't answer.
Correct. I actually suspect that romantic love is unique to humans.
I rather suspect as well. And is it then just an enactment of primate patterns to which we've added a little bit more complexity because of our higher intelligence?
I think it might be it shows a positive side of what you had mentioned before the break about how, these instincts, do we have to control them to improve the quality of our life? But I think in the case of, pair bonding and romantic love, it's a kind of instinct that serves us well, right? It helps enhance the quality of our lives by giving us this, drive toward or a little bit of a nudge toward this kind of strong relationship forming.
And yet, Dario, in your book, Games Primates Play, you draw rather heavily upon a line of analysis of human romantic bonding and unbonding or disbonding developed by an eminent fellow, indeed a Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago, Gary Becker of the Economics Department, which takes a very, very different view of what we're engaged in when we, quote, fall in love, get married, and then get divorced.
Yeah, Gary Becker was one of the first economists to do a cost-benefit analysis of what he called a marriage market. And essentially, the idea is that in a mating or a marriage market, there are individuals that have characteristics that many others want and individuals who don't have such characteristics. So take somebody like Angelina Jolie. She's a beautiful, young woman, talented, and very rich. So many men in the States would like to have a partner like Angelina Jolie, and many women would like to have a man like George Clooney. So these people are in low supply and high demand. So essentially, they can control the market. So the idea is that in a market situation, it's a competitive situation in which certain individuals who are well-endowed can pretty much pick and choose and others instead.
Well, you raise the problem, speaking of Hollywood characters who enact love scenarios for us in the popular prints, at least. You raise the basic question of why Brad Pitt and, what's her name, Jennifer Aniston, who were taken to be wonderful lovebirds, and they were married, and they had a child, and they were celebrated for their great romantic commitment to one another, and yet they split, and he, Brad Pitt, went to the other one you've just mentioned, namely
Angelina Jolie. Right.
And you have an explanation.
A theory as to why the first marriage did not work out. And part of the theory has to do with the fact that they were married for 7 years without having a child. And if you remember the movie, The 7-Year Itch,
yes. It
turns out that 7 years is a time period after which many couples get divorced. Actually, there's other data showing that it's between 4 and 7 years. So there is a theory as to why this might happen, as to why couples split up after this number of years. And that has to do with the fact that it's the minimum number of years that it takes to essentially have a child and raise the child successfully above and beyond the first risky infancy years. So in not-so-distant past of our species, evolutionary past, women had a child essentially every 4 years. So the idea is that a couple gets together, has a child, and then after the child is out of risk, is 4 years old, the couple sort of assesses the situation and decide whether they're happy together, want to continue, maybe have a second child, or split up and have another one. So I think Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston made a mistake not to have a child in those 7 years. And
But they split up shortly after they had, or even before that child was born. Is that right? They had the one child?
No. Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston did not.
Oh, they had no children ever?
They had no children.
I remember now what pregnancy I'm thinking about. When he split up, The other one was pregnant with Pitt's
correct,
child.
Correct, correct.
Angelina Jolie.
Yeah. So having a child might be a way to keep our relationship alive. And I think it's fair if a couple wants to have a child, but for some reason they don't have a child, that they reassess the situation and think about whether they want to be together.
But here we've got a social variable, surely, or at least a social variability across space and across time. That is to say, divorce rates are highly variable at different places and at different times. Our divorce rate, as we now know, is about 50%. That was not the case 50 years ago, surely.
Well, I think that actually points out an interesting idea to bring into these ideas about, these kind of instincts. So is there sort of like a clock going off in our heads at 7 years? I think it obviously affects some people differently than others. And I think that's something always to bring, into thoughts about, the evolutionary basis of psychology and behavior is there's a lot of diversity out there. People react in different ways. And possibly some people get that 7-year itch a little bit more, strongly than others. In fact, if you wanted to take the tabloid story and follow it out through, I don't know how true it is, but what you hear rumors about in the rumor markets is that perhaps Jennifer Aniston's relatively unhappy about the way their relationship has unfolded, where Brad Pitt is happy with Angelina Jolie. So perhaps he felt that 7-year itch more strongly than she did.
There is that curious extra factor. It just occurs to me. Angelina and Brad have only now, some years after their coupling, have only now announced they are going to get married in a while. They've been unmarried all this time. And cohabiting relationships, producing children and raising children among Hollywood couples and yet others are not at all uncommon. That is, cohabiting relationships without marriage. How does one account for that?
Well, some people think that the institution of marriage is becoming a little bit old-fashioned, that it's not keeping up with changes in our society, with changes in lifestyles. So they predict that fewer and fewer people will choose to be married in the future. But that's hard to predict. As you said, the divorce rates vary dramatically from society to society and also over time. For example, at times of economic crisis, fewer people get divorced because a divorce is really expensive, so people can't afford it. And so even though they're unhappy in their relationship, they choose not to get divorced.
If you really were, quote, in love, to be sure, we've much romanticized romance, and we've got a cultural tradition defining love, yet we have a lot of trouble really finally specifying what that emotion is and how it lasts and what sustains it or what tends to push it towards decay. But still, there's something there that is possibly unique to the human repertoire in terms of our emotional life. How does one account for the disappearance of love? You could say, well, we didn't produce kids, and so we lose interest in one another. That's what you were saying earlier, Dario. But we certainly are aware of lots of other strong romantic relationships, not among Hollywood stars, but among people we really know, which fade out. And which decay, and so that there's very often a movement away from a marriage on with strong motivation from both of the partners. That is, that they want out. How does one account for that? When, maybe another way to put it is, what kinds of or what modes of love last? What modes of love decay?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that, but it's as hard as it is to nail down what it is love. It's just as hard, I think, to get a handle on, what is the loss or absence of love. It's a great mystery.
Well, maybe you do have to start with defining what love is as experienced. If your heart goes pity pity pat, it's love, love, love. Goes this, an old song. Can you do better than that?
I think it's, again, perhaps best as one of those things, you know it when you see it or when you feel it, but I don't know how to catch it and bottle it.
It's such an important human experience. We have to do better at coming to terms with its nature and its provocations and its endurance or decay.
Well, one of the theories that I discussed in my book about why love evolved in our species mm-hmm. is that the function of love is to bring two people together at the beginning.
That's its evolutionary function.
Yes. Yeah. So the idea is that if there were no love, I think that people would get together all the time and have sex, but I don't think that they would stay together.
And they need to stay together for care of children.
Exactly, to produce children and to take care of them. So I think the function of love is really to bring people together at the beginning, not mm-hmm. necessarily to keep them together forever. So it's not surprising that in some relationship, love will fade. I think it's a natural
We're still skirting. We haven't defined what love is as an experience. Can you do that?
Love is an emotion, and I think the function of emotions in general is to energize motivation. Okay, having an emotion makes you want to do something, or makes you not want to do something. So I think love energizes our motivation to be with someone. Okay, to spend time with them, to share our life with them, to cooperate, and also to have children sometimes.
I think that's the right place we start, which is sort of drive to pair bond, and then get the benefits of that. And I think then as we start breaking down the benefits of pair bond, it'll take us to that kind of game theory analysis of why that's valuable, which I don't know, somehow seems to lose the essence of what love is when we start analyzing mm-hmm. the kind of business aspects of why being in a pair is better in terms of resource access for doing things like raising kids, passing on our genes.
In troops of monkeys or of apes in the wild or in the natural habitat, what do we observe? Are there many differences across different species?
Yes, there are species in which, as I said, there are pairs of males and females that stick together, and others in which mating behavior is very promiscuous. Everybody mates with everybody else. All the females mate with all the males.
Bonobos, for example.
Or chimpanzees or baboons, and many other monkeys.
Who are the matrimonially loyal primates?
They're not that many. Monogamy is actually quite rare, and according to some, it doesn't even exist.
Uh-huh.
So at least formally, there are species in which a male and a female will share their lives together, whether they're sexually faithful to mm-hmm. that's a different matter. but there are species of monkeys that live in South America. They're called marmosets or tamarins.
I see. As you go down the phylogenetic scale, this becomes true for yet other creatures. There are some birds who pair off matrimonially, aren't there?
Many birds. In fact, more than 50% of the species of birds
form
stable pair bonds.
Uh-huh. How do we account for that?
That's actually something that I can explain pretty well. It's the fact that to raise bird chicks, you need two parents. Uh-huh. So monogamy is correlated with biparental care. They need for two parents to cooperate. In many bird species, chicks will simply not survive if it's only one parent that takes care of them.
And is there role differentiation? Does the female bird maintain the nest and the male bird go find the worms that he brings back for feed?
No, typically they take turns. They both go out and find the worms.
Uh-huh. We are late for some commercials. This is very fascinating stuff. But we shall return directly after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are two psychologists at the table, and one, namely Dario, you're a biopsychologist, one might say.
Yes.
Trained in Italy, basically.
Yes.
But you've been at work in this country in academic life for some 20 years or so.
Correct.
How does psychology, as we pursue it here, compare it to psychology as they pursue it back in Italy or elsewhere in Western Europe?
I think psychology in Europe, at least in some countries, is still very much influenced by psychoanalysis.
My goodness, really?
Yes, whereas in the States, I think that psychology has moved away from psychoanalysis and moved a lot closer to empirical sciences. For example,
Freud has actually been dishonored. He's been critically treated, and there have been many historians and psychologists playing historian who've looked into the the early case histories and find that they were falsified, who also point up all of the theoretical confusions and rapid shifts, as if it were done by sleight of hand, in the various works of Freud on through the years. He adapted to just about everything, and that there's virtually no empirical evidence for the efficacy of psychoanalytic therapy. Apart from that, it's still a strong discipline.
Yeah, but not many people in France maybe or even Italy would agree with your conclusions.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
They feel that.
Well, there are still psychoanalytic training institutes, mm-hmm, including mm-hmm, the one here mm-hmm. in Chicago, who wouldn't agree either. Mm-hmm. But I never knew that American psychology to be fully dominated by Freudianism at any point.
No, not as much as it was in Europe.
Yeah. You mean even the so-called experimental psychology work mm-hmm. that you get done at the major universities?
Yeah, well, there was a tradition here in which behaviorism was very strong.
To be sure.
Before the war. And but then with the cognitive revolution, we know that...
You've named something very important, and one of the carriers of or inheritors of the cognitive revolution is Paul Reber, who runs the program in brain behavior and cognition. What was the cognitive revolution? What was or is the cognitive revolution?
Well, it's this idea of moving away from this sort of a behaviorist approach of, the world provides a stimulus and you choose your response, and bring in the idea of mental states that, there's cognitive processes happening inside the head. We can take those seriously and we can try to, characterize and quantify those and help use those to understand
behavior. It's not all Pavlovian conditioned reflexes.
I think it's a step beyond that. And then, now I think we're sort of maybe in the midst of another revolution toward cognitive neuroscience, where we bring in ideas from biology, from neuroscience, and say, now how can we connect those to the ideas? And one of the things I find, really intriguing about watching that is a lot of ideas are coming back from things that were characterized in behaviorism. It turns out a lot of that work that was done in animal models is great for providing insight on the basic neuroscience and ideas about how the human brain works that'll help us understand those mental states and mental processes.
Well, what have we really learned through about brain process? We've got new instrumentation, which makes the investigation of the actions of activity in the brain much more possible than it used to be, MRIs and things of that sort. But what really has that yielded in terms of useful knowledge?
We know a lot more about the neural basis of a lot of basic cognitive processes. We know how those break down and are affected in disease or damage to the brain. We see a lot of modularity and areas of the brain that, specific areas that take over complex tasks like memory or language or visual processing. We have some idea how those work, how they interact with each other, how those networks can then lead us to that kind of, emergent human behavior and, perhaps someday even to that understanding of where our unique human experience of consciousness comes from, the interaction among those billions of neurons in the brain.
Can we actually understand what's happening in the brain by tracking neural activity?
Well, we're learning more and more about it. Right now, the tools that we have give us great new opportunities to take pictures and take a look inside the brain that we haven't had before. But at this point, we're probably still working with technology that is essentially looking at the big muscles, the big processes.
It gives you the hot spots in the brain.
The hot spots. And the microstructure, I think, is still a little bit beyond our technological grasp.
Far beyond.
When I talk to my colleagues in radiology and the fancy tricks that they can pull with their scanners, they keep saying maybe it's not that far away. But I've also been hearing about that for a few years, so I wouldn't guess how long it'll be till we have more detail.
Dario, your views on the same?
I think brain sciences are fascinating. There's so much that we can know about how the brain works, and then we're also understanding the interaction between genes and brain, how some differences in brain function might be linked to differences in alleles that we have for particular genes. So there's also great comparative work being done comparing human brains and the brains of other apes because we're very similar in our bodies, but there are key differences in particular genes that are present in the human brain that are not present in the brains of apes. So this kind of comparative analysis of brain structure and function could ultimately, answer the question of what is it that makes us special.
I've been told by a paleontologist and people of that sort that that Neanderthal, as the most recent human species to go extinct, apart from Homo sapiens, had, of course, a larger brain case and probably had a larger brain, even in proportion to the total body. And it was a larger body on average. But that the great defect, so they were quite intelligent beings and were able to make tools and do a lot of stuff of the sort that primitive Homo sapiens did. But they did not have the kind of vocal equipment that we've got, did not have the sort of larynx and whatever it is and the sound box, which enables you to emit a stream of sound, which you can break up into vowels and consonants and thus produce language, arguing on that basis that the key to higher intelligence may be the ability physically to speak rather than speaking being a consequence of higher intelligence. It's a wonderful duality, which we might pursue further. I've always been very interested. I've never done any real work in linguistics. I did some work a long time ago with Starkey Duncan in paralinguistics, how we communicate through speech that isn't lexical, that doesn't really use any particular language. But I'd like to come to all of that when we return, after we pause right now, for a full update on the evening's news from Bob Kessler.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Paul Reber and Dario Maestri-Pieri in a conversation provoked by and guided by and responsive to the most interesting and really quite delightfully written new book by Dario titled Games Primates Play, and the full subtitle, An Undercover Investigation of the Evolution and Economics of Human Relationships. Let us go to the building where you have your laboratory or your office at the University of Chicago, the Biopsychological Sciences Building, and to the espresso machine in the lobby.
Yeah, we have an arrangement which is not unusual in many other working environments where there's a coffee machine and people go and make their own coffee, and then they mark a sheet on the wall, essentially recording how much coffee they drank, and then they'll pay a bill at the end of the month. So the idea is that people are honest and they record accurately how much coffee they drink. But somebody else who had a similar arrangement in a university in England did an experiment and put an image of two eyes sort of on top of the file cabinet where the coffee supplies were, and alternated this image with an image of flowers for several weeks. So 1 week there were two eyes and 1 week there were flowers. And it turns out that when the eyes were there, people paid more money. It's as if they thought that they were being watched, and that
it's as if Big Brother is watching you.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was all unconscious because it's obvious that it was an image, that it wasn't nothing real. But people are very responsive to images of eyes, and so this result has been replicated in other experiments where people, for example, take computerized tests, and if there are eyes in the desktop of the computer in the background, they tend to behave more honestly, or cooperate more, or pay more money, they donate more money. So the impression of being watched make people
And so that leads you to a chapter in which you talk about the difference between behaving when seen and when not seen.
Yeah, so the idea is that if others are watching, you want to behave in a cooperative manner because you might get rewards. For example, you gain a good reputation from being honest if your behavior is well advertised. On the other hand, if you try to cheat while you're being watched, you get caught and you pay a price for that.
You titled the chapter Cooperate in the Spotlight, Compete in the Dark.
Yeah, so the idea is that if you're under conditions of darkness instead, where you're not being watched, there might be an incentive to not to cooperate because you're less likely to get caught and to pay a price for. And so there are examples of that. I talk about a power blackout in New York City in 1977 where the whole city or part of it was in the darkness for several hours. And hundreds of people were mugged or raped and killed, and stores were looted, and police officers were attacked by people who had no previous criminal record. So the darkness conditions essentially prompted people to commit crimes because they probably thought they were not going to get caught.
You know that some social psychologists have suggested or have hypothesized that much human aggression is essentially situationally controlled rather than flowing from deep inner sources in the character of the aggressive individual. Phil Zimbardo, in his famous, though I think rather poorly designed, prison simulation study, came to that conclusion. Much more interesting, and we had occasion to mention it just last night when I was talking with Martha Nussbaum, and we got into matters of this sort somehow, that years ago Christopher Browning, an historian of the Holocaust, did a major study of one Einsatz. It was an Ordnungsbataillon in the German army whose task was to go kill Jews in the very beginning of the Holocaust, when they just rounded them up, took them into the nearby forest, shot them down after they had first had them dig their mass grave, and then put some lime over it and brought in another group and shot them down and laid them in the same big grave. And these were, Browning's book is titled Ordinary Men. These were ordinary men. They were largely policemen from Hamburg, a little bit older than the standard enlisted man in the German army at that time. They were in their mid-20s to mid-30s or thereabouts, commanded by two or three older men. They didn't join the army to go kill Jews. They didn't know that that was coming, nor were they necessarily all that anti-Jewish, even though they had been through 10 years of the Nazi system. But they ultimately did the task after some disquiet over it, or a few initially refusing to do it, because the other guys were doing it. And it was, you're sort of shamed by them if you didn't step up in a manly way to do this difficult but, quote, necessary task. Necessary, as the higher propagandists, whether officers or what have you, told you. Browning's conclusion from all of this is they didn't come to this task with any deep hate for the people they killed. They came to it as soldiers who had to somehow perform in a way that won the approval of other soldiers, even of their comrades. And thus a great deal of the evil done in the world is done essentially to satisfy those who command you or those who judge you. A good further basis for this kind of approach is, of course, given in the famous experiments by Stanley Milgram, where you got people to deliver what they thought were real painful electrical shocks to other people because the scientists said you're supposed to do this as part of an experiment in which you are helping us to test the learning capabilities of the subject.
Yeah, I don't believe that people have an instinct for aggression, or I don't believe that the human nature is evil or good or anything like that.
You don't at all?
No. I think that the human species has a high potential for aggression. So, but whether this potential is realized or not, that's a different matter. So obviously our behavior is sensitive to the costs and the benefits. So aggression can have benefits and costs. When the benefits are high and the costs are low, that's an incentive to behave aggressively. But when the costs are high and the benefits are low, we're happy being peaceful.
Going back to the Holocaust, how do you explain the difference between your country and its partner, Germany? The Germans, to quote the title of yet another book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, the Germans went to the task, whether they had intrinsic aggressiveness or not. They went to the task and they did murder 6 million people. The fascist regime, which originally inspired Hitler and which predated him while Mussolini was still in power, and the Italian army, for that matter, which was charged with rounding up Jews and sending them off under Nazi control to extermination camps in Poland, they resisted. They hid Jews. In essence, they did everything they could to stop the Nazi plan for the extermination of Italian Jews. There's a national difference there that has to be accounted somehow in historical or cultural terms, I should think.
Possibly, yes. I think that Italy was dragged into the war, essentially, by Mussolini. I think a lot of Italians were manipulated, and he offered this vision of Italy becoming this great power, having colonies and things like that. So Italians went into this war without having strong reason to do so, without thinking about the consequences. And in the end, once Mussolini lost the power, I think they were very happy to be out of the war and change sides and sides with the Allies.
Paul Reber, do you agree there's no intrinsic aggressiveness in human beings? In all? Or isn't there at least in some human beings?
I wouldn't have insight into everybody. I think maybe the right way to think about it is that kind of idea that there's a sort of an instinct to take care of yourself or to control the space around you or something that then, you know, filters through to other kinds of behavior. And I do think thinking about things from that kind of a game theory perspective, it does help provide some insight. And it's an interesting sort of a formalism that lets you jump from coffee machines to World War II, in a relatively seamless fashion. But you can see a lot of the same kinds of issues about decisions whether to cooperate at a coffee machine or with a, totalitarian regime. Some of the same issues about when do you cooperate with the order and when you defect from the order, have the same kinds of issues, like how strong is the social structure that's guiding you, and what are the risks or benefits of not cooperating?
You speak of a game theoretic approach to all of this. What does that really mean? Do a sidebar on that for some of our listeners who've heard of game theory but don't know what it means?
Well, a game theory is a sort of an artificial setup. A classic one is called the Prisoner's Dilemma game, where you have to make a decision. So you have two criminals who are accused of a crime, and they're each interrogated in separate rooms. You have to take the perspective of one of them, and you have to decide whether you cooperate with your co-defendant or you defect and rat them out. It's a model of a lot of decisions we make as we just travel around the world about whether we act in a generally cooperative and altruistic way, or when we defect, we're sort of acting in our own self-interest. And it gives us a lot of insight into, why it can be difficult in some cases to get altruistic behavior out of people, because you do have to take care of yourself. You have some of those instincts to take care of yourself, control the space around yourself, control your resources. But society works better when we get a lot of cooperation out of people. And so then how do we use those kind of higher functions or social structures to help, get more cooperative behavior, more altruistic behavior, which is better for society as a whole?
We are about to pause to take care of some of our obligations, and then on to the phones and to the email. So the lines have just now been opened, and we await your questions and your comments. If there are yet other aspects of human behavior, social behavior, which puzzle you and which you want to have addressed and possibly explained, now's the time to give us a ring on that. Or if you've got other observations on these matters and you want to share them with us, by all means, let us hear from you. 312-591-7200. Do you behave differently in elevators? Did you marry on a different basis than the one that we've been discussing tonight? Do you behave as well in the dark as you do in the daylight? 312-591-7200, the number. The lines are open, and we await your calls right now. Also, of course, for our internet listeners elsewhere in the country or elsewhere in the world, if you want to get to us from a great distance, whether, say, from Perth, Australia, or from Kuala Lumpur, or from London, where you're up quite early, the best way is via email, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720, as one word, at WGNradio.com. And again, for phones, 312-591-7200. We await your pleasure. We'll be directly back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we go directly to the phones, 312-591-7200. Anything about human behavior that puzzles you or that you think you can explain when others have not explained it properly, now's the time to give us a ring, whether to raise a question or, for that matter, to offer your brand of psychological wisdom. 312-591-7200. The lines are not full at the moment, I tell you directly. And so to my friends, I say, get in there quickly if you've got anything to say. It's the old man requires it of you. Move quickly at 312-591-7200. Sally is first up. Good evening. You're on the air.
Milt?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I was wondering if the discussions that your panel had there tonight, is anything what they said could be attached to or to the studies that Alfred Kinsey did? I forgot the name of the book he wrote.
Well, he did a number of books. They all had to do with the sexuality of Americans, basically, originally. And they're all totally discredited by now. But, gentlemen, what do you want to add to that?
Well, Kinsey, for the first time, tried to describe the phenomenon of human sexuality. So something that had been hidden. People did not really disclose their sexual behavior. Nobody knew how often people had sex, with whom, how common homosexuality was. So he wasn't really trying to come up with big theories about sex. He was really trying to describe the phenomenon, I think, in its entirety.
But the sampling was terrible. It wasn't in any sense a stratified or a proportional sample. It was essentially people he rounded up. Half of his, for the stuff on male sexuality, about one third of all of his population were people in prison, though that wasn't made clear in the introduction. And he personally, there's a lot that has been said about him, though he was rather heroically treated in a film that was done a few years ago. Our thanks to the caller, and let me read you an email I've got in front of me. I have friends and know of others who have said, I'm a people person. They'll even go about their days as a Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm or some sort of Pollyanna. But they live alone. Even when in a committed relationship, they prefer their own space. That doesn't seem very people-person-esque to me. Is single living such a modern trend? Has education and wealth made a difference? I've heard of wealthy people purchasing two homes in the same neighborhood, one for themselves and one for their significant other. It's interesting.
Well, one could say that maybe American society has become more individualistic so that people, first of all, tend to pursue their own needs and pleasures. And so if they're not satisfied, you know, living as a couple, then they rather live single. So they put the individual, ahead of maybe the couple or the family. So I don't know if this is a long-term trend, whether it'll last or not, but it's a reality.
I think it says something about, you know, just different instincts that some people, you know, have different ways they want to interact with the world around them, how much space they need, how much social affiliation they need. And so maybe somebody who says that they are a people person out in their regular daily lives can be more affiliative during that time so that they can, you know, have that private space later on in the evening. And, you know, other people may choose to organize their lives in different ways.
There's one guy at the University of Chicago, a social psychologist, who's got a lot of traffic with his proclamation. He supposedly has data to demonstrate this, that people who know other people and live actively with other people are much better off in terms of their physical status, their health, and that essentially living alone is misery and shortens your longevity and in general is bad for you. I think others might call that into question because there's a great deal of human variability in that regard.
It probably depends a lot about whether it's your choice to live at home or not. If it's somebody who just prefers to have their own space, there's certainly no reason why, you know, they wouldn't have other good health outcomes.
I had a very good friend who unfortunately died only about a year ago, well-known publicly, Robert Parker, the mystery novelist. His character Spencer in the Spencer series is very, very widely known. Bob Parker and his wife lived together, but separately. They lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they had a house, a large house. Not all that large, a house with two apartments in it. And she lived in one apartment and he lived in the other. This was not the way they lived all their lives, but they came to that as their mode of existence. And there was a good deal of visiting between the apartments, but each night... they would repair to their separate apartments. Some days they wouldn't see each other, but they remained good friends and remained more than friends. They remained a married couple. They were on this program together once talking about this arrangement. And the explanation was, well, we get on each other's nerves if we're together all the time. Is that a reasonable way of working out monogamy? I don't know.
I think, you know, the thing about monogamy is everybody has to find their solution. And if that's what works for you and you have the resources to set it up, then, you know, then that works.
But, of course, there are basic social changes that occur. We now have more single people of marital age in this country than we ever had before. So that about half of American adults are not married and living with a spouse. They may be formally married or separated or never married, but they're not living with another person of the opposite sex or of the same sex.
Yeah, in part, that might be for economic reasons. I don't know. It's expensive to start a family, and people sometimes get their first jobs later in life, and so it might be cheaper to just live as a single person until you have a more secure economic situation.
And then, curiously, in Europe, in some countries, particularly in the north, particularly, say, in Sweden, nobody gets married. People do live together. They cohabit. They raise kids, but they don't get married. They're just like Hollywood stars.
Yeah, and in Italy, men live with their mothers until their mid-40s.
Do they? With or without their wives?
Without their wives, but also with their wives sometimes.
Yeah. We're about to pause for an update on the news. And then directly back to the phones. Some lines are available if you want to get in there. Now's the time to make your move. 312-591-7200. We're all psychologists, whether you got the degree or not. We all think we know a great deal about how people behave and why they do what they do. And so we're interested in hearing from all of you about the behaviors that you can explain to others or that still puzzle you? And for that matter, any observations you've got about how other animals behave like us or we behave like them? Not only rhesus macaque monkeys, but many of us think about our dogs as being somehow very much like us. And think of if we could be more like cats, we might be better off. Let's talk about matters of that sort if they come to your mind. 312-591-7200 to the newsroom who was it? Bob Kessler, of course.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Paul Reber. Let's do some full reintroductions again. He is the in the Department of Psychology at Northwestern, where he heads the program in brain behavior and cognition. And Dario Maestripieri is professor. Let's give the full rundown here. Is professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology and psychiatry, and behavioral neuroscience at the Department of at the University of Chicago. And of course, he is the editor of the book that we've been drawing from tonight, and which is great fun as well as very instructive about proper approaches to thinking about our position in the animal kingdom and our difference from the rest of the animal kingdom, even our near relatives. The title of that book, Games Primates Play, An Undercover Investigation of the Evolution and Economics of Human Relationships. That's just published recently by Basic Books. 312-591-7200 is the number. There still are some lines available. Get in there quickly if you've got something to contribute. We'd be glad to hear from you. And we go next to Jeff, who has joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. How are you both doing?
I think fairly well. It depends very much on whether you have an interesting thing to say.
Well, I happen to have a good friend of mine who is married, and they live completely separate lives. He lives here in the Chicago area, and she lives in California. She has a boyfriend. He has a girlfriend. And they have businesses that they, I guess, are incorporated together. So they remain married, basically, for business reasons. They have two children that are actually older now and going to college. And they live in California with their mom, but they fly here often. I mean, they're financially well, so it's not an issue that way. But they live completely separate lives. I mean, completely. They're good friends, if anything, but they continue to remain married. They'll never remarry.
Let's come to country matters. I'll ask the question directly. Do they continue to have any sexual life together?
No.
It's not a marriage. They just haven't bothered to get divorced.
Right. They remain that way for just basically for their company, I guess, or their whatever it is that they have going on with each other financially.
How do you feel about all of that?
I guess if it works, then it works. You know, I mean, if the children don't seem to be affected in any way by it, they seem to be well-to-do and going to good schools and have a good relationship with their father. So.
Different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, they pay less taxes as defiled as when married.
That's true. Well, our compliments to them, or at least to the one you know.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. 312-591-7200. Next up is Mike. You are on the air, sir. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. I don't quite know how to phrase this question, but in combat, good men go bad in what we used to call bloodlust. Mm. Once you've experienced that initial situation of killing another human being, that adrenaline rush seems to never go away. And what causes men to want to continue to do that as often as they can?
I gather you've observed this in military life, have you?
I have.
Want to say a little bit about that?
Well, it's a situation that I guess you can never again duplicate that adrenaline rush, no matter what you try to do. But and the phraseology that was used is, well, you know, good men are going bad because they're getting the bloodlust and they look for this opportunity time and time again. But I just wonder, is that a social behavior that we suffer from?
It's a very good question. Let's turn to Dario on that.
Well, I think normally we all have inhibitions against, you know, hurting other fellow human beings. Yeah. and we would feel bad if anything bad would happen. But the war changes many things. I mean, wars are such unnatural and different circumstances where soldiers essentially are given orders to do certain things. They're told that it's to protect their country, and they're told to hurt and possibly kill others if necessary. So that has dramatic consequences of the way people think and their system of values. And so I can see how people can be changed dramatically and become different people and sometimes lose control of what normally controls their behavior.
Of course, random murder, a murder of strangers, very often serial murders or mass murders, that always makes a big headline, and it happens a great deal. Somebody walks into a McDonald's or into a post office and shoots down 10 people. We've had such incidents only in the last few days, I think, someplace or other. That kind of excess is always with us.
And I think that's what happened to that military person in Afghanistan. I think he got the bloodlust when he went out there and killed any number of civilians and children. And it doesn't matter whether it's a man, woman, or child.
Yeah, the fellow that quickly flew back here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it changes your life entirely forever, but it does something that makes good men go bad. And it's
absolutely
a horrible situation.
Further thoughts? Paul Reber.
When you're in a situation like that, you're being asked to, you know, transgress against, you know, one of the, you know, the worst, in a major way against what you might have believed before finding yourself in a combat situation. You also,
but you begin to like it. That's the problem.
Well, you have to sort of resolve this dissonance of you need to do it to stay alive, and the that sort of fight or flight reaction that you're going to have when you find yourself in that situation. I guess one of the questions there is how much of that is sort of like fighting those primal kind of instincts,
yeah.
I think in some cases where it really goes, you know, beyond like the unfortunate incident of the soldier who mm-hmm. did all those terrible acts in Afghanistan, is it revealing maybe an underlying psychopathy or something else that might have been wrong even before, mm-hmm. you know, being in that terrible situation?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, sir. A valuable contribution, I think. There's also the phenomenon of the serial murderer, not somebody in military life, but the guy who goes out and may kill one a week for a year, or may kill 10 or so. The very common pattern, as we all know, of killing prostitutes. What's the name of the famous British murderer, the Victorian era?
Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper, exactly. Killed a string of London prostitutes, and that's been happening again and again over the years. It's one pattern. Do we find any analogs for that sort of thing? The wild, mad murderer in a troop of monkeys or apes?
No. Murder is rare in nature.
Killing is not, but murder is.
Well, killing can be, for example, a form of predation, in which case I wouldn't even call it killing. If you kill an animal of another species
to eat it
as food, that's not killing. Deliberately killing, for example, a member of another group is something that does occur. For example, in chimpanzees, males that belong to one group are known to look for males that belong to another group, and if they find them, they beat them up and they kill them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes babies that are born to females from other groups are killed by adult males.
How does one account for that in evolutionary terms?
Well, you could say it's a form of competition. The competition between different groups is very intense. They compete for territory, they compete for females, and so when competition is so intense and these animals are pretty aggressive, then murder is just one extreme expression of competition.
We are about to pause for a last round of commercials. There are a number of lines available. I need some more good calls. Get in there quickly. 312-591-7200. Your reflections on some of the matters we've been talking about, or your own confusions and puzzles over some aspects of human behavior, which you think the three wise psychologists at the table can resolve for you. 312-591-7200. The lines await your pleasure. Do get in there quickly if you've got anything to say or to ask. And for that matter, if you want to reach us via email, again, the email address is extension 720 @wgnradio.com. Right back after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly back to the phones for your questions to Dario Maestrifieri and to Paul Reber. 312-591-7200, and Bruce is next up. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening. My question is kind of why, when somebody has a relatively aggressive behavior and gets into quite a few fights over the years, and then when they have children, at least in my situation, it's like totally calm me down. I can put up with a lot more BS and, you know, and kind of just let it flow over me. And I haven't, since my daughter was born 6 years ago, I haven't had to get in like a physical altercation with somebody over sometimes relatively stupid things.
Dario.
I have an answer for you. There's some research that shows that when men get married, and especially when they have children, that significantly reduces the level of testosterone that they have in their body. So testosterone is related to aggressiveness and competition and dominance, and there's now a lot of good evidence that the men who are single and who date a lot and change partners have high testosterone, but once they get married, and particularly after the birth of their child, their testosterone is much lower. So that explains your reduced tendency for fighting, for aggression.
Well, that happens even with mere age, whether you've got kids or not, doesn't it?
Yes, testosterone does decline a little bit with age. But, you know, if you're single and you keep on dating, you can maintain high testosterone if you're in good health till you're old.
Well, my daughter wasn't born until I was 42, and I think the last time I had, like, altercation was when I was 41, actually while my wife was still pregnant. But I just kind of wondered why, much like petting my dog, when I think about my kids, it kind of calms me down.
Well, you know, taking care of kids is incompatible with having an aggressive disposition, so you can't do both at the same time. You see the same in animals. In birds, for example, there's a time of the year where male birds fight with each other like crazy, and another time of the year in which they just take care of their kids, and they don't do the two things at the same time. You either do one or the other. Your body essentially is very different to when you're in a competitive mode versus when you are in a parenting mode.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you, sir.
Glad to have heard from you. We go quickly to the next, and that next is Mark. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milton. A question for your two guests. Is there any indication in primates of like an addictive, or I should say more obsessive behavior? You know, obsessively collecting things. I mean, obviously not being addicted to narcotics or anything like that.
You could probably addict animals to narcotics if you supplied them.
Yes, you can do that. You can also induce primates to develop highly stereotyped behavior, repetitive behavior, which seems a little bit like obsessive behavior, particularly in small cages in zoos. Sometimes you see this. But in nature, no. You don't see natural occurrences of obsessive-compulsive behavior like the things that we do where we collect small objects and things like that. No.
Oh, okay. I'm just thinking, you know, that, you know, some animals, it would appear they might collect certain things. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, they play with objects, but they don't do any collections in some sort of systematic fashion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And we go to Peggy. Good evening.
Hi. I was just wondering if, you know, when these people go sort of bazonkers, if there might not be a spiritual component to that. The reason I'm asking is because, you know, there was a woman in our church and somebody said, you know, she had arthritis or something, and this person said, well, I'll pray for your arthritis and you'll get healed. I'm really good at praying for this. And the woman said, wait a minute, could I say something? And she said, it's too late, I'm praying already. So she prayed and nothing happened. And the woman was really kind of sad, and she said, I'm sorry, it always worked before. And she said, it's okay. we pray to the Lord, and he said things are just wearing out. So, I mean, things do wear out. You know, there can be another explanation, but I wondered because, you know, like, there's the old Christian thing that they always do. It's very simple, and it always works, but nobody does it. And you might try it when you leave, but...
What's the old Christian thing you're talking about?
Well, all you do is look at a person in the eyes. Okay, you don't have to say anything. You be completely silent.
Well, then you're not on an elevator, obviously.
And you just say, God bless you. Now, if the person is an ordinary person, nobody ever gets blessed enough, and they'll usually smile. If they're another Christian, they'll really smile. But if they're under the influence of something demonic, if they're oppressed, not possessed, but, I mean, oppressed, you'll get a very hostile response because that thing will not want to yield the person. And it always works. And it's not hostile. It's not vicious or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a good thing. But I wondered, you know, psychology is so close in a lot of ways. And, like, they explain things. Sometimes it is spiritual, and sometimes it really is psychological.
Well, we need to discuss that in more detail, I think, than we possibly can do tonight with only 6 minutes left. And indeed, we have, on other occasions, examined the relation between science and theology, for that matter, and between the spiritual side of human nature and, if you will, the more mercurial or even the more animal side of human nature. But now is not the time to pursue that. With, as I say, time so short. Instead, we go to the next caller. Dave joins us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask the guests if they think that we are becoming more desensitized as a people because of modern living. I'll give you an example. I ride public transportation here in Chicago on the elevator trains. They have this horrible loudspeaker that comes on and announces it's constant chronic noise turned up all the way. And I notice most of the people, it doesn't seem to bother them. But I can't stand it. And I'm just wondering, what's wrong with these people? It's just really horrible. It doesn't seem to affect most of them. And a very few people hate it. And I'm just wondering, are we losing touch with ourselves? Or something happening to our nervous systems? Because all this electronic, electronic, whatever you want to call it, coming at us every which way.
Hmm. Paul Reber, you smile, I see.
Well, you know, it's terrible to have that kind of stress, noise stress. And I bet a lot of the people who are on the train are actually probably being bothered by it, maybe have learned, if anything, just to simply suppress their annoyance and response to it. And, you know, it's known that chronic exposure, that kind of stressor, you know, is not great for your mental state. You probably can learn to ignore it to some extent. I'm not sure I would blame it on the sort of advance of technology because, you know, you do occasionally run into transit systems that run in a more quiet and less, you know, invasive fashion and they're not quite as obnoxious to people.
But I mean, people are becoming so accustomed to chronic noise nowadays where I believe a generation or two ago would be driven mad by it. And I think that this is not a good thing. I can see it happening in certain individuals and large groups of people. I just think it's going to be, I think it should be recognized as a public, a potential public health hazard.
Again, a topic for another night, and indeed we've done programs pretty close to that very concern. I do thank you, sir, for the call.
Okay.
We are only about 2 minutes away from the end of available time. What other exciting facts do we have in this book that we haven't mentioned tonight? Give me one or two of them.
We haven't talked about how two male baboons assess their mutual trust when they make alliances, and why is it that the word testify comes from the Latin word testis, which means testicles.
They hold each other's testicles, and you say that the ancient Romans did that as well.
That's right. Two ancient Romans who made a pledge of allegiance would hold each other's testicle in their hands.
And that's the origin of testify.
I believe so.
That's wonderful.
And the idea is that sometimes to really know whether another individual value your relationship, you have to behave in a way that is very intrusive and stressful and potentially dangerous to see whether this person tolerates your behavior or not. And on the other hand, you would let somebody else touch your intimate body parts only if you really like this person and trust this person. And so baboons use the same principles, and it kind of makes sense, I think.
And the Romans did it, you say. Mm-hmm. But we've abandoned that, I think, as a,
yes,
as a measure of
usual growth. We've developed different codes of behavior when it comes to intimacy, and we don't do that anymore.
Give me one other item.
Well, along the same lines, for example, there are interesting things that other monkey species do to test whether their favorite social partners are still committed to their relationship. So they will walk up to a monkey that they like, and then they will stick their finger up their nose, and then they wait for a response. And if they get smacked in the head, it means that the friendship's not so good anymore. Whereas if the other one patiently puts up with this annoying behavior, then it means they're still friends.
And do we have a human equivalent to that, I wonder?
Well, there are people who argue that many expressions of affection and love in humans have stressful elements that, things like French kissing or even sex, you know, if you enjoy and tolerate these things, it means you really like the other person.
And on that note, I think that's the right note on which to end. We will end with thanks to our two guests, Dario Maestri-Pieri and Paul Reaver. We will not be here tomorrow night. We're preempted by the hockey game, but we'll be back in full force on Thursday night, on Wednesday night. And I have more to tell you about the very significant program that we've got arranged for that night. But now it's time to say good night, and therefore good night to all, and a cordial good night indeed.